You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 19th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brian Hockman, professor at Georgetown University and author of The Listeners, A History of Wiretapping in the United States. And later in the show, Talia Levin, journalist and author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy, is here to talk about great replacement theory. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania's Senate GOP primary still hasn't been called as of right now, I believe. And yet Donald Trump is already telling Dr. Oz to declare victory. Just tell them you've won and you win. That's what I do. Even when I win, I lose. That's some solidarity with TV hosts.
Do the Buddha gig.
In good news, Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal has endorsed Jessica Cisneros in her runoff against anti-abortion Democrat Henry Cuellar. That race is next week in Texas. The House has passed a $28 million bill to address the baby formula crisis in the country. All the no votes were Republican. This comes as Biden has invoked the Defense Production Act to speed up getting formula from overseas. Our supply chain is just A+, right? The white supremacist who murdered 10 black people at a Buffalo supermarket is scheduled to appear in court today. Turkey's President Erdogan has blocked a procedural vote on NATO moving forward with Sweden and Finland's application for membership. And Viktor Orban of Hungary is doing his part for Putin, blocking an already watered-down EU effort to embargo Russian oil. This all comes as a month-long siege of Mariupol ends after a last stand by Ukrainian fighters. And lastly, new contracts have been reached with the U.S. Soccer Federation that guarantees equal pay for women and men when competing in international matches and tournaments. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. We have a great show ahead for you. In the fun half, Matt Binder will be joining us to break down his much-discussed debate with Tim Pool. We have some clips for you. We're going to go deep dive into that, not just when he gratuitously brought up Sam in order to, I guess, demonstrate to the rest of the world that he doesn't really, he's not over that still, seemingly not over that. But first, you know, we're going to dive a little bit more into news. That U.S. Soccer Federation equal pay thing, I feel like that was a really long time coming. That's been a debate for years and years, and given the success of female soccer players and their team relative to the male team, which, what, they didn't even qualify for the World Cup this year, right?
I got to double check because I think they didn't last time. They didn't for last World
Yeah,
time.
Right.
They are significantly less like talented than
yeah. Well, team. I mean, and the popularity, like it's just an open and shut case, frankly. So good news there. But this went viral last night. I mean, George W. Bush was speaking at the George W. Bush Institute. So, you know, the crowd is going to be...
For kids who can't read good.
Right, exactly.
You want to learn to do other stuff good, too.
What is this, an institute for war criminals? The answer is yes. So he was speaking, and he made, like, the most Freudian of Freudian slips. When discussing Putin's invasion of Ukraine, he mixes up Putin's invasion of Ukraine with his invasion of Iraq.
In contrast, Russian elections are rigged. Political opponents are imprisoned or otherwise eliminated from participating in the electoral process. The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia and the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq, anyway. 75.
Yeah.
Yep.
He says Iraq, too. Like
Iraq, too.
He
as
concedes
a,
it.
As like, a, well, I mean, like, I think he's trying to make a joke like, oh, he, you know, Putin's also invading Iraq. But no, you were the lone man with the
no,
unjust.
No, he knows what he did. Like, yeah. That's him saying, oh, crap, I know what I did. Iraq, how silly I could have said that. How silly of me to have confused these two illegal invasions. I mean... he did that because that's very similar sort of problem.
Very similar situation. Frankly, you saw a lot of the language used by Vladimir Putin in terms of like liberation, all these kinds of terms that seemingly he borrowed from the United States.
Be met as liberators.
Right, exactly. So there were lessons learned from...
Putin contemporaneously with Shock and Awe said he was a fan of it.
Oh, yeah. And so, I mean, I think that it's evident that a lot of the propaganda he used and the justification is copy-paste from that. But I just want to thank the Democratic Party for rehabilitating this guy and pretending that all things that were bad about the Republican Party come from Donald Trump. I mean, you know, he handed Michelle Obama a piece of candy and the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians and Iraqis in general that died. It just washes things away. Like, the idea that this guy has no accountability for Iraq and he can just laugh about it and laugh about, oops, I made an oopsie at his own institute and the crowd's going to laugh along with it. I mean, we should not be laughing. It's gallows humor. It's inherently hilarious that he made this flub, I guess, you know, because people forget. But George W. Bush was prone to these kinds of flubs. But the fact that he's still walking around doing these kinds of speeches. No real, as I say, accountability for his actions. And he still has the gall to stand up there and call for accountability against Vladimir Putin and talk about the differences in American society versus Russian society and why we're inherently better. Based on our actions, what makes us inherently better? I mean, he's like, oh, we don't imprison political opponents. I kind of almost want to go back. Can you just play again the first part of it where he's standard American propaganda, but... Yeah, just the first few sentences of this.
In contrast, Russian elections are rigged. Political opponents are imprisoned or otherwise eliminated from participating in the electoral process. The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia and the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq, too. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, the Bush administration expanded the executive power to incredible degrees. He acted alongside the rest of his cabinet in this way, to invade Iraq in a wholly illegal, unjustified way. It still makes my blood boil that this war criminal is able to walk around and make little jokes about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's not more to say, but like the last thing really is it's important for us coming from a United States context to put these things into perspective because frankly, coverage in US media, CNN, whatever, which has been all over this, leaves out all of the context that the United States participated in and was at the forefront of an invasion of Iraq that is very similar, longer, and more deadly to this point. And that the United States continues to support financially Israel in its brutal occupation of Palestine and expansionist imperialist endeavors in Palestine, where there's a ethnic cleansing happening. We financially support that. So you have to look at things not from, like, you know, what jersey each country's going to wear, what country's doing it, what's inherent to each nation. You have to look at things as what a power. What does power do? What does power mean? What does imperialism mean? And George W. Bush is a great example of that. Folks, I took this gummy last night. So this ad is very timely. And Bradley didn't tell me we were doing it today. So look at that. I use this product just on my own because I like it so much. Well, you told me this morning. And last night, I use the Sunset Lake Sebade gummies. Sunset Lake Sebade is excited to announce a new product, sleep gummies. Sleep gummies include a blend of Sebade, Sebe-N, and melatonin, especially formulated to help folks fall asleep and stay asleep. Not only do these elderberry-flavored gummies taste delicious, they are vegan. Now, I used it for the first time last night. I love the taste. I've been using the tincture almost every night from Sunset Lake, and this did the trick, too. I can't wait to try it again tonight. To celebrate the release, Sunset Lake Sebade is offering 30% off sleep gummies and their original sour Sebade gummies. Starting Thursday, May 19th, all Sebade gummies, including sleep gummies, will be 30% off. Use promo code SLEEP for 30% off. The sale starts today. Already started. It started this morning and ends next Tuesday, May 23rd at midnight. Visit sunsetlakesebade.com to try these amazing new products and take advantage of this sale while it lasts. It ends on May 23rd. Again, use promo code SLEEP for 30% off newly released sleep gummies and classic Sebade sour gummy bears, which are, like, very tasty to boot, I might add. All right, folks, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Brian Hockman, professor at Georgetown University and author of The Listeners, A History of Wiretapping in the United States. We are back, and we are joined now by Brian Hockman, professor at Georgetown University and author of The Listeners, A History of Wiretapping in the United States. Brian, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Emma. Appreciate the time.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation because, well, let's talk, I guess, really broadly at first, the concept of electronic privacy. You can conclude from your book that basically, while it's an ideal, it's never really existed. Would you say that that's a fair assumption or fair conclusion based on your work?
I think it's fair, but only up to a point. Electronic eavesdropping is entirely coextensive, historically speaking, with the rise of electronic communications, which suggests that Americans have, almost from the beginning, in the middle of the 19th century, felt a kind of loss of privacy, even though they've enjoyed the benefits of ever-expanding communications advancements. That's kind of a grim story, however. And the other side of the coin is, I think, an important story that my book has uncovered, which is the extent to which Americans have really rallied around the cause of electronic privacy for much of the history of electronic communications. Really, up until the late 1960s, the majority of Americans didn't like electronic surveillance under any circumstance. All of that changes on or around 1968, and we very much live in the world that that watershed year made. But one of the things I was surprised to uncover is just how central the cause of electronic privacy has been to American political culture, really from the 1860s and up until the 1960s. All of that changes afterwards, however.
And that change really has to do with like a backlash to racial progress in this country. And you see in the late 60s, after that, in the 70s, we're seeing the drug war ramp up. I mean, is that a pretty much direct cause and effect relationship that you can draw in terms of the embrace in America of wiretapping?
I think so. Up until the late 1960s, wiretapping was regarded by most Americans as a dirty business. The majority of Americans, upwards of 75%, according to some surveys, argued that agents of the state should not be allowed to use electronic surveillance, even under judicial oversight. By 1974, that calculus has changed, and most Americans accept the wiretap as the kind of tool of art in the service of law enforcement's most complicated investigative priorities. And the shift really occurs in the in and around 1967, 1968, as a response to the uprisings in Newark and Detroit and a kind of backlash politics on the part of Southern Democrats and Republicans who wanted to empower law enforcement in the name of law and order. We generally don't regard the wiretap in particular, and electronic surveillance more generally, as a kind of dirty business today. It's standard investigative procedure in the service, say, of the drug war. And that's really a result of this shift that happens as a result of this attempt to empower law enforcement in the wake of the civil rights uprisings of the late 1960s.
Let's, I guess, go back to the beginning and the first iterations of wiretapping when it gets invented, basically, or starts to be used. I didn't realize that the Civil War was the real beginnings of this practice, because communications need to be intercepted, that it's standard, wartime intel gathering. Talk a little bit about that history and how it came to be. War spurns innovation in many ways, and there's a lot of tentacles to that, but this was one of them, obviously.
This surprised me as much as it surprised you. I didn't know, quite frankly, before I started working on this book, that wiretapping dates back to the 1860s in the era of the Civil War. The American Civil War is the first conflict, military conflict, in which the use of electronic communications, i.e. the telegraph, proves decisive on the battlefield. And as a result of the centrality of the telegraph to the unfolding conflict, both sides, the Union and the Confederacy, invented ways to intercept telegraph messages. In short, they intercepted the art of, or invented rather, the art of wiretapping. What's interesting about wiretapping in the age of the Civil War is that the devices that Union and Confederate signal operators kind of invented and pioneered on the fly in the field, these were devices that could both intercept Morse code as it traveled across the lines live from one sender to a receiver. But also these devices could send disinformation, fake news, in other words. So military wiretappers in the age of the Civil War kind of invented this new technique. It was the source of considerable fascination in the American press, again, in both in the South and the North. And in fact, military operations abroad in, say, the UK, in Britain, in their imperial forays in countries like Egypt in the 1870s and 1880s, they followed the American model of using this technique of wiretapping, or what the British called wire milking, to their military benefit.
So then, I mean, was it very frequent during the Civil War? Did it drop off after the war ended? I mean, what is the trajectory of wiretapping? I guess more my question is how it was used and how it evolved in Reconstruction, post-World War, or post-Civil War, at the end of the 1800s.
So this is a story that the book follows in its opening chapters. Wiretapping is celebrated during the war and immediately after as a novel military art. But as the telegraph proliferates, as it reaches a saturation point in the workings of the American economy in particular, as the American economy begins to rely more and more on electronic information, very quickly the wiretap falls into the hands of crooks and con men. And it kind of it has, over the course of the 19th century, a fall from grace. It goes from this noble art of military
espionage
strategy, and falls into the hands of crooks and con men who want to game or rig the stock market. And I've uncovered some really fascinating cases of stock market criminals, and also to get ahead on gambling as well. I've uncovered tons of cases in the late 19th century of wiretappers, electronics experts, who would tap into the lines of horse racing pool rooms to find out the results of races prior to their announcement. And they could make surefire bets as a result of the information that they had overheard. This really dominates the image of the wiretap for the balance of the 19th century and well into the 20th. And when American law enforcement begins to adopt the practice in the 1920s, in the age of prohibition, they really need to shake off this criminal image that the wiretap has accrued over the course of almost 40, 50 years.
What were some of those examples of stock market manipulation and thievery that you found?
So there are it's hard to generalize, but the basic kind of structure of the scheme, and this was copied in various guises over the 1870s and the 1880s, is finding a way to tap into the telegraph lines that fed stock exchanges, or what were known as bucket shops. These are informal kind of betting parlors that Americans would go to wager on fluctuating commodity prices. If you could get that information just a fraction ahead of time, you could make surefire investments. It's a little like the sort of Michael Lewis Flash Boys model of the early digital moment in Wall Street, when stock traders are using electronic know-how to make trades in advance of the market's fluctuations. That's a very old story. And electronic criminals in the 19th century took advantage of that relationship, that new dependence on electronic information. And I've uncovered some really interesting stories dating back all the way to 1864 of this sort of arrangement.
Gotcha. I'm trying to remember. There sort of is somewhat of a practice. Is it Robin Hood or some of the other traders that get information a second ahead? It's flying out of my head. I was about to ask you, but forget it. That's a whole separate tangent. So you talked about Prohibition's role in shaping wiretapping and how it manifested itself in America. Was it World War One or Prohibition that accelerated this? This more you say Prohibition, but or did they accelerate it in different ways?
So, law enforcement's interest in the workings of the American telephone system as it's evolving date back to the 1890s. I've uncovered records of the NYPD tapping telephones as early as 1895, for instance. And wiretapping evolves in the arena of American law enforcement and fits and starts over the course of the ensuing decades. But it's not really until Prohibition that it becomes a tool of art in the service of enforcing the law. And there's two reasons for this. One, more generally, is that there is an uptick in investment in law enforcement in the age of Prohibition. You created this new class of crime, and you need a new population of crime fighters to go ahead and solve the problem that the 18th Amendment had created. But more importantly, large bootlegging syndicates relied on the telephone for their operations. And more interestingly, what I've uncovered is that those large bootlegging syndicates also exploited the police's use of the telephone in the early 1920s. You could get ahead of the cops, so to speak, if you intercept their telephone calls. And starting in the late 1920s, the Prohibition Bureau around the country, in a series of incredibly high profile cases, including the landmark Olmstead case of 1928, get in on that act and kind of copy what the bootleggers had been doing to them all along. There's kind of feeble legal justification for so doing, but it becomes an important and controversial tactic that the Prohibition Bureau adopted as a result of the war on alcohol and bootlegging's reliance on the telephone system operations.
Yeah, well, one, it's fascinating to me how there are just... When you look at history, there's a lot of different examples of law enforcement stealing practices from crime syndicates and using it themselves, and this is another instance of that. And two, how Prohibition really does mirror what happens decades later and continues to this day with the DEA and some of those practices and the broad the breadth of with which they're able to investigate with dubious legal practices in terms of the legality of it, the crimes that are being committed. But I guess I'm a little curious too about how this coincides with not just Prohibition, but, and I think they go hand in hand, the creation of the FBI, for example, which we know is used to target civil rights activists and communists, etc. What role does that play as wiretapping becomes more promulgated?
So this was an aspect of the story that surprised me somewhat. The FBI has, or what was then known in the 1920s as the Bureau of Investigation. It's not rechristened as the FBI until 1934, 1935. Can't remember the exact date. It has a very narrow investigative mandate to start out. And in fact, when the straight-laced or then straight-laced J. Edgar Hoover assumes the directorship of the FBI in 1924, his first comments on the use of wiretapping in investigative tactics, in the Bureau's investigative tactics, were condemnatory. He believed that wiretapping was unethical and that essentially... agents of the Bureau who were caught using this tactic should be disciplined or even dismissed. Obviously, his stance on wiretapping changes as a result of a variety of factors in the ensuing decades. But the Bureau doesn't really get in on the act in earnest until the 1940s and 1950s. And that's the result of a series of secret investigative, kind of national security priorities that emerge in the fight against communism, actually on the part of the Roosevelt administration, surprisingly, given its kind of liberal character. The Roosevelt Doctrine, as it was known, this is the product of a secret Roosevelt memorandum transmitted to the Attorney General and the FBI in 1940, basically said that it was legal for the FBI to use wiretapping, even though wiretapping was seemingly illegal in other forms, if the Bureau was doing it in the service of enemies, in the service of investigating enemies of the state. And Hoover seizes on this clause, this memorandum, as carte blanche for pursuing all manner of communists and subversives and later civil rights advocates and activists in the 1960s. But even then, the FBI's use of wiretapping is not nearly as broad as it would seem in memory, in terms of just the sheer numbers.
And in terms of the when Prohibition ends, the apparatus is still there, essentially, right? And the FBI kind of envelops it, which is interesting to me. I mean, what at that point in history, where does wiretapping and these kind of surveillance practices take a turn once, you know, alcohol becomes legal again?
Well,
the communists, right? Or that's around
yes,
that?
Yes, I would say so. But one of the main arguments that I try to make in the book is that the rise of the wiretap in America and the rise and codification of U.S. state surveillance more generally isn't merely a knee-jerk response to fears about communism or domestic subversion, or even later terrorism. Instead, it's a kind of gradual accommodation to a set of political priorities and law enforcement imperatives that have helped to build the modern carceral state. So yes, it's true that the rise of Cold War anti-communism feeds the codification of a kind of coherent U.S. surveillance state in this country. But legally speaking, politically speaking, culturally speaking, far more important is the rise of law and order politics in the 1960s. And that's really when the wiretap gets normalized as an investigative tactic on the ground of America's streets in communities of color. And really when the wiretap sheds its history as a kind of dirty, seedy tool used only by crooks and not by sanctioned and upstanding agents of the state. So one of the arguments that the book is making is sort of pushing back against that dominant narrative, which I think there's good reason why I think Americans remember the story in that way. And it's not to say it's not true. It's just that I think the story really lies elsewhere, and it has to do with the history and politics of U.S. law enforcement.
Gotcha. I want to move to that time period shortly, but I just have one more question about this time period, because Brandeis on the Supreme Court is known as, you know, a protector of privacy, and there was some pushback in terms of his rulings in the 1930s. Can you talk about that? Because while yes, it's embraced later on, there was, as you say, a little bit more pushback, less of an embrace during this time period, and that was manifested itself in the courts.
So it takes a really long time for wiretapping to get legalized as a tool of law enforcement in the United States, even under judicial oversight. So the Supreme Court rules in 1928 that wiretapping does not constitute a search or a seizure, and it's therefore constitutional under the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. However, it took almost four decades for Congress to pass a law codifying that sentiment and establishing what constitutional electronic surveillance would look like. There's a great deal of back and forth that happens in the period between 1928 in 1968, when that's when all of the landmark laws are passed. There's a variety of reasons for this. There's legal reasons. It has to do with competing jurisdiction. But really, it has to do with this baseline sense that American politicians in Congress, in Washington, in the states, subscribe to this mainstream political position on both the left and the right that electronic surveillance was bad and was dirty. And despite the kind of rapid advance of wiretapping and eavesdropping technologies in exactly the same period, wiretapping still exists in a strange legal gray area. And it's the result of political agitation on the part of, say, the ACLU in the 1930s and 1940s that prevents wiretapping from becoming a tool of law enforcement, legally speaking. And also members of Congress, like a forgotten congressman whose story I trace in the book, Edward V. Long, who was the most visible privacy advocate in the 1960s, their actions helped to delay the codification of wiretapping as a tool of the state over time.
But as you say, it was just a delay because civil rights movement happens and then the backlash is going to happen. And it did. And then we see tough on crime legislation, law and order legislation, policing, etc. So I guess take us to the end of the 1960s when the watershed moment really for wiretapping happens.
So the best way to understand that story is to think about Edward V. Long, this Missouri senator who I just alluded to. Long becomes in the 1960s the foremost American advocate for electronic privacy. And with the support of the Johnson administration, by 1967 has crafted a bill known as the Right to Privacy Act, which would have banned wiretapping in all of its forms, the private use of wiretapping, law enforcement's use of wiretapping in criminal investigations, and also severely limited the federal government's or the FBI's use and abuse of the wiretap in the service of national security protections. That law looks like it's going to get passed in the winter of 1967. But by the fall of 1967, Long has basically become persona non grata, and the White House abandons its support for this landmark legislation. So what happens, the question becomes, between the beginning of 1967 and the end of 1967? Well, it's the long, hot summer. 134 cities across the country erupt in flames, in racial violence. And a new form of politics becomes mainstream, this law and order consensus. And as Long exits stage left, on stage right enters an Arkansas Democrat, a segregationist named John McClellan. And McClellan crafted a law that becomes Title III of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act. This is a law that bans the use of wiretaps and electronic eavesdropping equipment on the part of private individuals, but also permits law enforcement to use wiretaps and bugs under judicial oversight. And what's so interesting about McClellan's judicial victories, his regulatory victories, is that they were explicitly animated by a racial politics. He's on the floor of the Senate in 1967, filibustering against the Right of Privacy Act, saying we need wiretapping to tap H. Brown and Stokely Carmichael and these Black Panthers who are causing America's streets to erupt in flames. I'm going to give law enforcement all the tools they need to keep America's streets safe and make America whole again. And as extreme as McClellan's rhetoric was, it ends up getting supported by the White House, Johnson's administration, in 1968. And Johnson signs the Safe Streets Act and Title III of the Safe Streets Act into law in July of that year. So really, there's a kind of whiplash effect that's the direct result of racial politics and this law and order consensus that emerges out of the as a consensus out of the law and order crisis of 1967, 1968. And we still very much live in the world that John McClellan made and that Edward V. Long didn't make.
So, I mean, Black people in this country in the civil rights movement were always subjected to a wildly disproportionate amount of policing. But would you argue that this just allowed this both expanded it and codified it into law as a way of like ushering in this new tough on crime era where more and more surveillance of Black people and leftists as well would be allowed, and it kind of created this explosion?
So law enforcement's abuse of the telephone tap, say, or the hidden microphone in the service of harassing civil rights activists dates back to the World War I era, as many scholars have shown. It doesn't just begin with Martin Luther King and the Black Panthers. But I don't think it's true to say that the watershed legal transformations of late 1968 expands the government's surveillance powers immediately. It certainly codifies them into law, but there's a crisis immediately following the passage of the Safe Streets Act in 1968 of what it is now that law enforcement is going to do with its power to tap telephones. And they spend about a decade, law enforcement across the United States on the local level, the state level, and the federal level, trying to figure out how to use this new tool at their disposal. And in its earliest incarnation, the legalized wiretap is brought to bear against gambling syndicates. And it turns out...
Full circle,
exactly. It's one of the great ironies of the history that I've traced. It turns out that tapping telephones to break down gambling syndicates doesn't really do much damage to those syndicates. And also, it's a massive waste of time and resources for law enforcement. And by the late 1970s, there are all these police officials, state officials who are kind of worrying about what to do with this power that they have and how is the wiretap going to work for them. Enter the war on drugs. And it's the war on drugs that finally expands the state's electronic surveillance powers. Of course, Nixon begins the war on drugs in the early 1970s, but it's not until Reagan raises the battle flag in 1983 that really the wiretap gets resurrected as the investigative panacea. And if you think about television shows like The Wire and other kind of American cultural artifacts that have celebrated the law enforcement's use of electronic surveillance tactics in the service of the war on drugs, it's really a product of that moment. So this is a long way of answering the question, which, like, I don't think 1968 expands the state's powers because it doesn't come until a decade later. There's a lag.
Right.
Other political forces need to enter into the picture. But certainly 1968 codifies the state's role and normalizes it as well.
So it takes 10, 15 years for law enforcement to catch on, like, oh, wait, this is going to be super helpful. Plus all of the other expansions of their resources and their abilities with the war on drugs. You put those two together, and now we have the modern police state. And you mentioned Reagan there. Talk about his role in both expanding and cementing this electronic surveillance as accepted and normal, and in particular, as a way to target Black people and Black communities.
So I almost want to push back on that narrative, but not in the way that you think.
Okay.
Yes, Nixon and Reagan matter to this story, and the backlash politics of law and order matter to the story, in particular the rise of the wiretap as the investigative tool of art in the war on drugs, brought to bear disproportionately on communities of color in the United States. But it's important to recognize, as many historians before me have, that law and order is essentially a political consensus after 1968. And one of the ironies, perhaps, or maybe not, of the history that I've traced in the last third of my book is that the most dramatic codifications and expansions of the state's wiretapping authority in the 20th century have all come under Democratic leadership. So think back to Lyndon Johnson signing the Safe Streets Act in 1968, and fast forward then to Bill Clinton in 1994 in his landmark crime bill. 3 weeks after signing the 1994 crime bill that...
Yeah, who wrote that, by the way?
Well, which parts of it?
Well, I'm joking, yeah. But I mean, right. but in terms of that still being in our politics, it's...
Very much true. But fast forward 2 weeks, 3 weeks after that, Clinton signs into law a little-known piece of legislation known as the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. This is a law passed in 1994. This is part of the crime control push on the Clinton administration that essentially makes it necessary for communications companies to build surveillance capacities into the very infrastructure of electronic communications themselves. It mandates communications firms to manufacture their new technologies as surveillance ready. This is a law, it turns out, that doesn't apply to the internet, which becomes very important in the 21st century, but it's a critical piece of the story in supporting law enforcement and supporting the project of law enforcement surveillance. And this is all a product of the war on drugs and the law and order consensus. So Reagan matters, Nixon matters before him, but really we should also think about how their politics has become mainstream and become a source of many of the relationships that we're arguing over and battling over today.
So that point about the communications companies basically having to have this reciprocal relationship with law enforcement, that's immensely important to, I think, looking at modern day, surveillance capitalism, the Edward Snowden revelations, et cetera. Can you expand on that point? How that relationship was formed, how deeply embedded it is, and if we want to understand how we're being, I guess, surveilled today, that it's important to understand.
So as privacy advocates in the 60s, 70s, and 80s argued, and I'm using their language here, forgive its strangeness, Ma Bell has been Big Brother's handmaid from time immemorial, which is to say that communications companies like AT&T, the Bell system, have been cooperating with the priorities of law enforcement all the way back dating to the 1890s. And this is a story that I trace in the book. Those NYPD wiretaps that I alluded to earlier, starting in 1895, those were all conducted with the direct assistance of the New York Telephone Company. And over the 20th century, AT&T and also regional telephone providers proved extraordinarily amenable to assisting law enforcement. It's kind of how they resisted government regulation. It's kind of like, well, we'll give you the wiretaps when you need them, when you want them. We'll help you in whatever way you can. We'll keep it all under wraps as long as you don't, break up our monopoly. That begins to change in the 1980s with the breakup of the Bell system. But the relationships, say, between Verizon and the NSA or between AT&T and the FBI that Snowden revealed in the mid-2010s, these were very old relationships that were kind of an open secret and also a necessary evil from the perspective of some Americans for a very long time. So eradicating that relationship means eradicating a very long history and also trying to work against the very logic of market capitalism. Again, it was incredibly important for AT&T to cooperate with law enforcement over the course of the 20th century, just by dint of the fact that they didn't want the government to do anything. They wanted to remain in the government's good graces. Those market forces are still at work today, albeit in much more complicated guises.
And the complication, it becomes much more complicated in the war on terror, right? In terms of just the intricacy of the relationship, can you talk about how things evolved post 9/11?
So it becomes both more and less complicated. The war on terror coincides, of course, with the digital revolution, which created all manner of new opportunities for local, state, and federal law enforcement to get in on the act of eavesdropping. Since the 1980s, it's become really difficult for law enforcement to, on their own accord, without the help of a communications firm, to listen in on your telephone calls. There's no wires to tap anymore, in short. But as soon as digital tracking becomes dominant, as soon as social media becomes a platform that the world is using and also abusing, all sorts of opportunities emerge. So there's a sense in which wiretapping as a tool of art is deprioritized in the war on terror, because there's all other opportunities that are easier. There's like just a wealth of digital electronic information that's out there that law enforcement and other entities can, corporate entities as well, can have at their disposal for their own use and abuse. But wiretapping has also persisted, and we need to think not in those terms about the war on terror, but still about the persistence of the war on drugs. Upwards of, in any given year, 85 to 90% of the telephones that are tapped in this country are all done not in the service of national security investigations, as we might expect, but still in the service of the good old war on drugs. And that persistence of those political priorities and of that law enforcement imperative has made for more continuities than discontinuities from the rise of the war on terror after 9/11 and the rise of our digital society after or about 1999.
And despite, we've documented the failures of the war on drugs, I think, numerous times on this program, it's easy to look up in terms of rates of addiction or death or drug use remaining static or going up, even as increased funding goes to the agencies that are to law enforcement for the war on drugs. So I think in the U.S. we're more aware of the futility of the war on drugs. Regular people are. And yet nothing's changed. This is deeply entrenched, and wiretapping and electronic surveillance is a part of that. Do you see anything changing in that area, even as, you know, cannabis becomes legal throughout the country and there's a recognition among lawmakers like we have to repair what we've done? But nothing seems to have changed. I mean, Biden certainly isn't changing, and he doesn't even want to legalize marijuana on the federal level, for example.
So I don't know if I'm equipped to answer the policy details of that question. But one thing I want us to think about is the technological side of it. That's really where my bread is buttered as a historian of technology, as a cultural historian. And I think it's true to say that wiretapping, for better or worse, electronic surveillance is here to stay, whether it's in the war on drugs or elsewhere. There has never been a concerted attempt to revisit the passage of Title III of the Safe Streets Act in 1968, and there never will be. It's regarded by most legal scholars as good law. However, we might think about new technological forms that are as intrusive today as the wiretap was seemingly to Americans in the 1960s. And there is some hope on that front. If you think, for instance, about the incredible work that has been done at the local level around the country resisting the use and abuse of facial recognition technologies on the part of law enforcement since 2015, 2016. I think the future of facial recognition may look different than what the future of wiretapping looked like in 1968. And I think it's because Americans are a little more alert to the harms and the biases of facial recognition technologies. And there's also, I think, some definite sense on the part of the majority of Americans that empowering law enforcement with any and all manner of militarized technologies isn't necessarily good business. So we'll see what happens. I'd like to end perhaps on a note of hope that maybe facial recognition technologies will be more tightly controlled, less widely used than certainly wiretapping and electronic surveillance technologies have been from 1968 until today. But it remains to be seen. And if history is any pretext, then, well, we're going to end on a very grim note indeed.
Well, I mean, it seems appropriate, frankly. Brian Hockman, professor at Georgetown University and author of The Listeners, A History of Wiretapping in the United States. Brian, thanks so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Great discussion.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks, Emma.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking to Talia Levin about Great Replacement. I believe Talia is going to call in. So we'll be opening the phones temporarily for her. And then, never mind. Okay, we're taking a quick break. We are back, and we are joined on the phones by Talia Levin, journalist and author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. And Talia, you wrote a piece in Rolling Stone that I think is essential reading to understand what happened in Buffalo. So thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course.
So I think as someone who studies extremism in this country, it's sort of like you have this inevitable kind of Cassandra feeling.
Yeah.
Of just like people maybe pay attention in the aftermath of massacres, and it would just, you know, I think it's kind of like, well, you know, we've been yelling about this stuff for a while. You know, I wish people like didn't have to die horribly in their own communities for there to be a modicum of attention to the like humongous problem of right-wing extremism in the country.
Absolutely. So let's start, I guess, at the beginning, really. What is great replacement theory? You know, the entirety of right-wing media is downplaying it and pretending that it doesn't exist, or it's just the other side of wokeism, of the wokeism coin, which is inherently ridiculous. But, you know, we heard Jews will not replace us being chanted in Charlottesville, and this theory was used as justification for the El Paso shooting, the Pittsburgh massacre as well, and now again. So I think it's important for the audience and for people to understand its origins and what it even means.
Yeah, as well, I should add, as the Christchurch mosque massacre and the horrific Christchurch mosque massacre in New Zealand, also directly cited Great Replacement Theory as its inspiration. So essentially the idea is this. I mean, so like, people, some of the more mealy-mouthed and misleading conservative sort of rebuttals to people pointing out the absolute ubiquity of this theory in conservative media is, you know, they say, okay, like, you know, simply acknowledging demographic change is great replacement theory, and that's not the case. So what it is, you know, positing that demographic shifts in the United States and other countries that essentially make countries that have had white majorities into countries that do not anymore have white majorities, whether those are birth rates, immigration, you know, or other shifts. You know, first of all, you have the theory sort of posits not only are these a bad and dangerous thing, but also that they've been maliciously and intentionally engineered by, you know, their political opponents. So that like can take the form of lots of different like different kinds of language to describe the, you know, evil enemy du jour. The sort of laundered mainstream Republican version is that it's Democrats doing it for electoral advantage. The straight up white supremacist theory that this shooter espoused, that the Pittsburgh shooter certainly espoused, you know, and used as the basis for why he wanted to massacre Jews, is that it's Jews doing it in order to create a less white and therefore more malleable, you know, public. This is a very racist theory as well. But so, in other words, like, what you're hearing from, you know, the bad faith argument that you're hearing over and over again right now from conservative pundits is that, you know, oh, like, anyone who simply acknowledges the fact of demographic change is viewed as a conspiracy theorist by these Democrats. And that's not the case. The theory is that the replacement is that it is a replacement, that it is being done deliberately as opposed to sort of being a function of the fact that populations change in nature over time.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. But when you talk about the original white supremacist language, about how this is orchestrated by Jewish people, this demographic change, when it's spoken about by Tucker Carlson or by Republicans, they speak about replacement, but they use stand-ins, frankly, for Jews. I think this is the deliberate way to dog whistle for their base, and in Tucker's case, it's I mean, obvious as hell, in my opinion. But they'll use elites, they'll use globalists. Expand on that if you could.
No. But you know, the idea is that it's more sanitized because it's not sort of explicitly saying. I mean, as this shooter did, as the Pittsburgh shooter enacted, you know, kill the Jews. They're the source of this sort of demographic replacement. The point, you know, first of all, there is a significant amount of anti-Semitic dog whistling that's happening. You're absolutely right. But also, I think it's worth noting that, you know, even in the quote-unquote, like, sanitized version, you know, what you have is consternation, intense consternation over a change in demographic makeup. And that's being treated as if that's sort of a natural anxiety without anyone sort of pausing and saying, wait, why? Why do we have to treat, you know, this, the idea that, like, the country will be less white as sort of a natural point of panic? Like, why do we have to legitimize that? I don't think we do. You know, and why do we have to say that it's, you know, let alone give credence to the idea that it's being nefariously orchestrated as opposed to, you know, the demographics of population change over time. Demographic change in and of itself, when it's not sort of a feature of war or of killing, is not a morally neutral fact, right? And so, like, the other name for this theory that's very commonly used in white supremacist circles is white genocide. That is what they call it. And, you know, because it's like, oh, they're deliberately trying to erase us in our own countries. That's the language that's used. That's the tone that's used, is this sort of apocalyptic tone, this us or them, you know, and what that ultimately means is that in this theory's worldview, for a person of color to be born, it is a violent act, right? So it's very extinction level logic. You know, it's annihilatory logic.
Yeah.
Its argument is, you know, because we face the existential threat of becoming minorities, first of all, like, the birth of people of color is sort of suspicious or criminal or just bad. You know, the anyone arriving for a better life in this country is an agent of sort of deliberate demographic rigging. You know, I mean, it's a heinous logic, and it's an annihilatory logic.
And I mean, it's based on a foundation of racist tropes about super fertile non-white people, about, yeah, replacement, as you say, this fixation on fertility rates. His manifesto also included anti-gay, anti-trans rhetoric, I believe, or at very least his Discord posts. So you can just see where he's grabbing these things from. And it's not what I'm frustrated by in terms of, like, the mainstream discourse surrounding this is that, yes, this is an extremist ideology that was embraced by this murderer, but frankly, it's the extremist part of it. You can find cruder forms of it online, or purer forms, if you will. But most Republican politicians engage in this rhetoric on a daily basis, let alone top-rated cable news hosts who talk about replacement regularly, like Tucker Carlson. Can you just talk about how mainstreamed replacement rhetoric is in both conservative media and among Republican politicians, like, you know, the new cool brand of Republicans backed by Peter Thiel, J.D. Vance, Blake Masters? I mean, they're engaging in this all the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was looking at sort of how many candidates have embraced various forms of this theory, with the sort of most common and quote-unquote sanitized one being, you know, that, oh, Democrats want to change the nature of the electorate for electoral advantage, and that, you know, is just relentless. I mean, it's also ubiquitous. It's, like, really difficult to overstate just how, you know, much this is a bog-standard talking point. And, like, so the shooter was radicalized in, you know, these the sort of 4chan, open neo-Nazi, you know, white extremist internet, right? And that is to a degree, like, a separate ecosystem to a degree. I think, in fact, though, it's the feeding ground is more of the reverse. Like, time and time again, we've seen specifically Tucker Carlson, actually, his writers, draw on, you know, racist memes, draw directly from 4chan for their broadcasts. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is sort of an extension of that broadly across the Republican Party. It's like only the most extreme ideas have a home right now. That's where we're at. And the other piece of it is, like, it's impossible to extricate this theory. It is deeply racist, yes, both for its tropes about hyperfertility and also for the ways in which it imputes that non-white immigrants, that non-white people in general, have no agency. Yes. You know, that they're sort of, like when Republicans try to sort of woo black people, they inevitably, use this horrifically racist rhetoric about, you know, getting off the Democratic plantation. You know, you've heard these phrases many times. So again, like, it's this idea that, you know, non-white people have no agency. They have to be directed by white elites in order to act in any form or fashion. They have no sort of distinct mind. And obviously this is not only deeply racist and deeply it's deeply racist, it's deeply anti-Semitic, and it sort of exists at the nexus of both. And that's, you know, to see that as functionally the backbone, the rhetorical backbone of one of the two major political parties is beyond concerning.
100%. Last question before I let you go. I do appreciate your time today. You know, your Rolling Stone piece is entitled "The Buffalo Shooter Isn't a Lone Wolf. He's a mainstream Republican." And in your book that came out 2 years ago, I believe, you went undercover on these far-right extremist online forums, subjected yourself to a ton of hate and vitriol directed at you. And so, you know, the culmination of this kind of rhetoric can lead to. I mean, is this very much in keeping with or an acceleration of some of the things that you uncovered in your investigative work on this kind of extremism?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, as I said before, the logic of treating, you know, any group of human beings, you know, their very existence as an existential threat, that's an annihilatory logic. And, you know, one of the things about being an extremism reporter, as opposed to, you know, a Washington political reporter, is that my concerns aren't sort of access to this or that, you know, famous person, this or that political operative. My, you know, like, I don't have a game to be playing that involves access to anyone in particular, particularly as someone who is Jewish and someone who is a woman. And therefore, like, the reason I went so gonzo in my reporting is because people wouldn't talk to me because of who I am. It's for the book, Culture Warlords. And, you know, I think I have been watching with trepidation and with kind of horror as the ideas that I saw, you know, first in the, you know, environment of open neo-Nazis, people who embrace, you know, the term white supremacist, right? As they have migrated into the Republican mainstream, they have become just the de facto positions in the Republican Party. And to say I find that horrifying is, you know, obviously an understatement. I think it's concerning. It's existentially concerning. It's a deep threat to non-white and Jewish people in this country. And there was a report by the institution, it's IREHR, a human rights organization that tracks extremism in the U.S., and that found that some 11% of all state legislators, you know, across the country were members of extremist online groups. You know, we really have a groundswell. And, you know, I understand that I understand both from my inbox and, you know, mostly from my email inbox that my article was sort of inflammatory or upsetting to some. But I think at a certain point, you know, particularly when you don't have to worry about access or politeness, you know, and you're not trying to get on anyone's good side, you're just trying to tell the truth, you have to sort of call it like it is, or you're not doing your job. And I have watched the things that I started out seeing as sort of manifestations of the worst extremism, the most fringe extremism in this country, migrate directly and squarely into the mainstream.
Well, can't thank you enough for your time today. Talia Levin, you can read the piece that we discussed here in Rolling Stone, and you can also pick up Talia's book, I just want to make sure I get the title right, Culture Warlords, Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. Talia, thanks so much for your time today.
I also write a newsletter on Substack. It's called The Sword and the Sandwich.
Oh.
Would love you to subscribe. I write about extremism and sandwiches.
Well, I mean, you got to lighten it up, right, a little bit?
Exactly.
Really appreciate it, Talia. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.
All right. With that said, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, man of the hour is going to enter into the room. And as we do that, though, man of many hours, Matt Leck, will tell us what's happening over on Left Reckoning.
Yeah, Saul Rad of the National Iranian American Council came on last night. We got in, talked for about an hour on sort of the Iran deal, the failure of America to honor it, the sanctions and how they affect people. And we had a really good discussion. And in the fun half, we talked about, not Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, coming out against UBI in a way that is upsetting his Reddit in a very severe way. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that.
Amazing. All right. With that, Matt Binder. Hello. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing
well.
How
are you guys doing?
Sorry we went a little over. I just wanted to be able to talk to Talia about white supremacy. Wanted to get that in this Thursday. But
no, it's a good conversation. One that a certain someone I spoke to this week did not want to have.
Well, we're going to be diving deep into that in the fun half. everyone check out Doom, check out Scam Economy. What's happening over there?
All right. So on Doom this week, it was Tuesday, and I literally just got back from my journey to the Tim Pool compound. So the discussion was about my conversation with Tim Pool on Monday on his show. We had a number of callers, a lot of callers, and quite a few of them were Tim Pool viewers. And while they didn't all agree with me, there were some who did. And actually, we're very upset with some of Poole's what happened on the show, I guess. We talk about it more in the second half. So check out Doom this week at youtube.com/Matt Binder. And on Scam Economy tonight, I will have Molly White on the show again. And we're going to be talking about how Wikipedia listens to the Wikipedia community and canceled their long-standing policy accepting cryptocurrency donations. We get into, you know, how that happened, why they canceled it, what the community did.
Authoritarian censorship.
Right, right, right. But it's actually a really interesting discussion. And for anyone who, you know, big no surprise, Molly, who herself, she's the creator of Web3isgoinggreat.com. Everyone should check out that site. But she's also been a longtime Wikipedia editor herself. Like, she's well known in the wiki community. And she's the one who brought this, like, this policy question to the forefront that got them to actually stop taking crypto donations. So it's really interesting discussion, because anyone who is worried about crypto creeping into whatever it is you love, listen to what Molly has to say about how you could do something about it. So that's tonight, youtube.com/Matt Binder, scameconomy.com, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And I'm just going to drop this really quick. Patreon.com/Matt Binder if you'd like to support the show, anything I do, such as debating Tim Pool. Patreon.com/Matt Binder.
Love it. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. We do not have time for calls today.
Brandon today?
Sorry.
Yeah. Brandon's out of town today, so okay. just us four.
I thought four. I said that. Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, Brandon's out today.
Five,
but...
sorry. Wrong math. There's five of us.
One,
today.
Two, three. No, there's four of us.
Is it just four of us? Am I an idiot?
You counted
Am I the dumbest person alive?
You counted me twice.
Of course, I had to.
Yeah, I mean, as you should. We won't be taking your calls, guys, because we really have a lot to get to with this Tim Pool debate. But we will be reading your IMs. See you in the fun half. Oh.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who? Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8? Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all?
Yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.